You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2012 Toronto Fraternal Gathering. The speaker is Brother Mark Vincent, and this is the fourth address in his series, Things Done Twice, God's Hand in the Life of Joseph. And this address is entitled, Joseph Wept, and was recorded on April 7th, 2012.
Well, brothers and sisters, let's go back to chapter 42. So Joseph has become Lord of all Egypt, but his brothers and his father are still in the land of Canaan and getting pretty hungry there. Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, "Why do ye look one upon another?" And you can feel Jacob's exasperation there with his sons, can't you? Jacob, of course, the go-getter, the one who likes to find a way out of situations, around situations. And the brothers, who are now the able-bodied men, who should be the providers, aren't they? They're doing nothing. They're just sat around getting hungrier and hungrier. And Jacob has to sort of cajole them, say, "Come on, are you guys going to do anything about this? I've heard that there's corn in Egypt. Why haven't you? And why haven't you done something about it?" And it's as if the brothers are sort of frozen. They're just sitting there looking at one another. "Have you got any food?" "No, no, have you?" "No, no, I haven't got any either." And you wonder if the consequences of what they did to Joseph all those years before are still sat heavy upon them and have brought about a kind of paralysis. And they know something's wrong. They know that there's something that has to be addressed. They know that they can't go on like this forever, but they don't know what to do, do they? They know they need a way out, but they don't know, they have no idea what that way out could be. They know something's wrong, but they don't know what it is or how to address it. And that's a kind of a parable, isn't it? Because what they need, we know what they need. What they need is to be reconciled to their brother again. They need to be forgiven for what they've done, and they need to be able to move past that and on. But they don't know how any of those things can be accomplished. And so they sit there looking at one another, and Jacob gets increasingly frustrated. And he says, verse 2, "Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die." So this is a matter of life and death that the brothers have to address. And all the way through now, there's going to be this ambiguity, isn't there? Because on the surface of the story, it's going to be about one thing. It's going to be about going to buy food. But we know that the real thing that's going on is not about food, is it? It's about reconciliation and forgiveness and whether or not there is a way in which that can be achieved. And that is the real life and death issue here for the family. So off the brothers go to Egypt, and verse 5, here they are. "Sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth." Ah, here it is. What had been predicted in those dreams all those years ago. This is the first now of a whole series of bowings, and that's not meant to be there. That is meant to be there. A whole series of bowings that the brothers enact before Joseph, and even Jacob himself, you'll see towards the bottom of the last two of those, I think, and about Jacob bowing, the sun and moon and stars bowing down before him. And this is the first one that we've just read there in verse 6. And so what's Joseph going to do? How is he going to play this? Well, verse 7, "Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, Whence come ye? And they said, From the land of Canaan, to buy food. Now, there's a surface way of reading that, isn't there? But I think there's quite a lot in that verse. You notice it says that he knew them. Now, we've met that idea before. Do you remember how the sons had said to Jacob, Know now whether this be thy son's coat or no. And Jacob knew it and said, Joseph is without doubt torn in pieces. And we talked about how he's completely wrong in all of that recognition scene, wasn't he? He misrecognized. But Joseph knew. So Joseph now is the kind of the antidote to his father, isn't he? Joseph perceives and Joseph knows. And Joseph knows what is in man, like the Lord Jesus Christ knew, and he recognizes his brothers. And it says that not once, but remembering that this is a tale told twice, it says it two times. Verse 8, And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. And if we were to look at verse 23, we'd see it says, And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. So do you notice that twice it says, and there's a slide on this, I'm sorry about this, I did arrange all these slides in the right order, and I didn't save it, and then I had to shut down my machine. There they are. Two times it says that Joseph knew his brothers, and two times it says that they did not know him. And that just fits the pattern, doesn't it? And this is by God's divine decree, if you like. This is by God's ordination. This is God's stamp upon this whole scene that's unfolding before them. So back in verse 7, Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, and he made himself strange to them, and spake roughly unto them. And that's interesting, because that picks up what it said way back in chapter 37, that his brothers hated him, and could not speak peaceably to him. Joseph now gives them a taste of their own medicine, doesn't he, by speaking roughly to the brothers. And that's not characteristic of him. Normally Joseph speaks peace to people. He asks people how they are. He's concerned about the welfare of others. But now, of course, Joseph is carrying out a particular thing with his brothers in order to bring out of them what needs to be brought out so that this reconciliation can take place. And so he speaks roughly to them, just as they had once failed to speak peace to him. And so they're getting their comeuppance now, aren't they, for the way in which they behaved. And he asks them a question. He says unto them, these are his opening words to them, Whence come ye? Now that could be an innocuous question, couldn't it? So where are you from? Or it could be a question which is altogether more penetrating and insightful. Where do you come from? Because we all have a history, don't we? We've all come from somewhere that goes beyond the physical location in which we were grown up, but is about the whole history that we've been through and what it means to be you and what it means to be me. Because what we are today is made up of all that history that came before, isn't it? That has had its impact in making us who we are. Where we came from has brought us to where we are today and who we are. And so it's useful to think about that question, Whence come ye? Where have I come from? Because if I don't know where I've come from, then there's not a whole lot of point in having come from there, is there? I might as well have come from someplace else. But if we believe in providence and that God's hand is shaping us and bringing us through on this journey of our lives and refining and shaping and molding our characters, then where we have come from and those experiences that we've had are hugely important. Whether they were good experiences or bad experiences, They have been there in our lives and are part of making us, under God's hand, who we are today. And if there are things to be learnt from that, then you've no idea what it's like to be me, have you? And I've no idea what it's like to be you. And God has brought that about, that miracle of our own histories that we each have had. If we've yielded to him and submitted to his hand in shaping our lives, then that's what it is. God has brought these things into our lives and brought us to where we are today. So it's worth thinking about that question when it's coming. You see how pertinent a question it is for them, because in their past lurks something that they have never admitted out in the open and that they can't talk about to anyone. Now, probably, you know, there are a few things in our pasts that are a bit like that. You know, maybe not of this magnitude, perhaps, but in some cases, perhaps. But there are all kinds of things, aren't there, that have happened to us in our lives and experiences that we've been through. And what the brothers need to do is to accept their past and to find a way of dealing with it, of being forgiven and moving forward. So the question that Joseph asks, though it seems to be an innocent enough question, is far from it. It's actually a very deep and searching question. And the whole of what Joseph does with them, in playing with them the way that he does, and making them afraid, and putting the money in their sacks, and then accusing them, and so forth, all that is helping them to answer that question. Where have they come from? And where do they need to go? Now, let's carry on in verse 9 now. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, "Ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land are ye come." Now, this point about spies is staggering, really. Just how many times Joseph accuses them of being spies, and how many times they remonstrate with him that they are not spies. So, you know, is this just a kind of a random accusation that Joseph thinks of, you are spies? You know, might he have picked something else? Why did he choose to accuse them of being spies? Well, a spy is someone who is duplicitous, isn't it? Someone who pretends to be one thing, but is in fact something else. And these brothers had pretended to be brothers, hadn't they? And they pretended to their father that they'd found Joseph's coat and it had been devoured by a wild animal. But in fact, it was them that had done it. They had pretended to be something that they weren't. And they had been something that they shouldn't have been. And so, you remember we talked about Joseph being consistent in all the different circumstances that he was in. The brothers were the exact opposite of that. And that's what a spy is. Someone who is duplicitous in that way. Who has one life and then another life, which is the reality. And the brothers now need to find out what the reality is. They've been both ways, haven't they? They've been brothers and they've been people who take their brother and cast him into a pit and sell him into slavery in Egypt and pretend that he's dead and deceive their father and watch their father suffer for all those years. That's what they've been. What are they going to be going forward? And he accuses them of coming to see the nakedness of the land. Wasn't it them who had stripped Joseph of his cloak and effectively made him naked? And so now he accuses them of coming to do the same thing again, coming to see the nakedness of the land. And the one word picks up the earlier experience. And they insist that this is not the case. And they say unto him, Nay, my Lord, verse 10, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. And he says, Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land are ye come. And you see now that he said that twice, hasn't he? Now. So they insist that they are true men, and here are all the references in this passage to the truth, their honesty, their truthfulness, the fact that they can be trusted. All this language to do with proving to be truthful, it's just piled on in this chapter, isn't it? We are true men, they say. Oh, yeah? We'll see how true you are, is effectively the path that Joseph now takes. And what's interesting is that in their eagerness to prove how true they are, they volunteer information that they don't need to volunteer, don't they? So they've stopped now, and they say, we're 12 brothers, and we're the sons of this man in Canaan, and one of our brothers is not. And they don't need to tell Joseph any of that, but they're volunteering this information to prove just how true and honest they are, which Joseph hasn't asked for. And of course, by volunteering that information, they just pull themselves deeper into the trap that Joseph's building for them, don't they? And it's just delightful irony for us watching this play out. And they discover that it's actually not so easy to be truthful, is it? The truth hurts. And Joseph makes the truth hurt for them by seizing on what they say and say, okay, well, if you say you got a brother, prove it. Bring your brother down and we'll see. I'll be the judge of that, whether you're true men or not. And so they're forced to bring Benjamin down. So the brothers have laid their own snare, and everything now in this chapter happens twice. We see it happening, and then the brothers go back home, and they tell Jacob everything that happened. Again, it's a tale told twice. Now, I'd like to come to another pattern. We've come across a number of patterns, haven't we, in the Joseph narrative. We've come across the contrast between the beginning of the Joseph story and the end of the story. We came across this telling of things twice, didn't we? Because this is revealed twice, it's because it's from the Lord, and God will surely bring it to pass. We've seen that. Well, there's another pattern that has to do with things that happen three times. Now, you remember that there were three descents of Joseph, we said, didn't we? Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt, and that was the first one. And then he went down into the prison house, and then he was kept in the prison house and forgotten in the prison house when he hoped that he was going to escape. Those three descents of Joseph. And now, corresponding to that, Joseph will require that the brothers make three trips themselves down into Egypt. So first, the 10 brothers come on their own. This is the trip that we're reading about in chapter 42. And Joseph says, all right, you've got another brother, do you? Okay, well, bring him down. And so the brothers have to go home and they have to come back with Benjamin. So that's the second trip. And you see that Joseph is gradually bringing about this reconciliation, because now he has not just the one brother himself and the 10. Now he has himself and the 11 brothers. So all the brothers are together, but there's still something missing. There's Jacob missing. And so they have to go up out of Egypt again and back down the third time. And it's only then, after their third descent into Egypt, that this reconciliation and unification of the family can happen. And similarly, when you remember in the butler and the baker, the dreams that the butler and the baker had, Joseph said, in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and your fate will be determined. It's as if the 3 days are like, the three is like a proving period. Joseph had the three descents. The brothers have to make these three journeys down into Egypt before the reconciliation. The butler and the baker had to wait 3 days for their fate to be determined, whether his head was going to be lifted up to buttle for Pharaoh again, or whether it was going to be lifted up from off him and the baker was going to die. And And, of course, that links perhaps also to the three trials that Jesus had, we might think of, and another passage in chapter 42. Let's have a look in verse 17. And Joseph put them all together into ward 3 days. So they just have to sit there 3 days, not knowing what's going to happen. They've just had this conversation with Joseph where they've insisted that they're true men, and Joseph has insisted that they're spies. And Joseph, of course, has the last word and says, right, I'm going to lock you up for 3 days, and we'll see whether or not you're spies. We'll see just how true you are. And so they sit there in prison with no idea what their fate is going to be. And that fits in again with this same pattern of three. Now, let's look at what Joseph says to them. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine, and bring your youngest brother unto me. So shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And they did so. Now, did you notice there was something at the start and at the end of that speech that we just read? Joseph began by saying, this do and live. And he ended up by saying, and ye shall not die. So Joseph's whole speech here is framed by life and death, isn't it? Whether they're true men or not, whether they will bring their brother Benjamin down, whether they will look after him as they failed to look after Joseph, whether Jacob will let Benjamin go so that he can come down and their words can be proved, this is a matter of life and death for this family. Only if those things happen, only if the brothers are good shepherds this time, good brothers, only if Jacob lets Benjamin go, will they live and not die. This really is a matter of life and death. Now, the brothers, of course, are in consternation about this. And what's so interesting now is that we get an insight into their own minds, what they were thinking, how they reacted to this, to these things that were happening. Verse 21, and they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is distress come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child? And ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. And they knew not that Joseph understood them. So, they're starting to get it, aren't they? They realize that this thing that's playing out between them and this leader of Egypt now, and this being put into prison for 3 days, they realize that this isn't really about that. It's about something else. This is about what happened years ago and what they did to Joseph. They all recognize it, don't they? And I suspect this is one of those things that they, in their past, that they, I don't know if they could even admit to it in their own consciences. I don't know. I'm sure their consciences plagued them, but would they allow themselves to really go there? Did they ever talk about it to each other? I imagine this is one of those things that was never mentioned, even when they were on their own. And no one else was around, and they could have talked about it, and the guilt that they felt that had plagued them all those years. And it's only now, when the odds are stacked against them and that this Egyptian lord puts them under this pressure, that they finally come to admit it to one another. And they say, we know what this is about. And of course, they're absolutely right, aren't they? They start now then to recognize the problem. We are verily guilty. Ah, not true men then. We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Now that makes a contrast with what you actually read in chapter 37, because we won't do it now, but if we were to go back to chapter 37 and watch that scene playing out again, you remember in chapter 37, Joseph didn't say anything. He was the passive victim, wasn't he? We talked about active and passive. He was the passive victim of what they did to him. They took him and stripped him and cast him and sold him and brought him. And Joseph, as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so opened he not his mouth. And as far as the narrative in Genesis 37 is concerned, Joseph is completely silent, as befits the type. However, what actually happened is now released to us, isn't it? So Joseph did cry. Joseph did beseech them and say, please don't do this to me. And they would not hear. So Genesis 37 hides from us the cries of Joseph, doesn't it? To make Joseph a type of Christ. And this now releases, years later, it's as if those cries of Joseph had been bottled up for all those years. And only now, in Genesis 42, as the brothers finally at last talk about this thing that happened, Joseph's cries are released to the world, to us, to Joseph. And Reuben repeats it. Do not sin against the child, he had said. And the brothers would not here, twice. And they didn't know that Joseph could hear them. And then Joseph selects a brother from among them that he's going to keep as a ransom while they go back and fetch Benjamin. And that brother's name is Simeon, whose name means hearing. So Joseph heard what they said, didn't he? He picks up the fact that they've just twice said, we wouldn't hear. And he's listening to them saying that. And he picks out this brother. I wonder if they did a double take when he picked out. Why did he pick out Simeon? So they stand now, in a sense, at the brink of transformation. Why? Because, or at least, that may be a little strong, they stand now in a position where transformation is a possibility. Why so? Because they've recognized the problem, haven't they? They've now admitted to themselves, which is a start, what they did. And Joseph has heard them admit it. And that's crucial, isn't it? That's a crucial step in the process of salvation, that we admit what we are, that we recognize our sinfulness, and that we do it not in just some general way of, I know that human beings are sinners, but that I am a sinner and you are a sinner, and that we did thus and so specific thing, which was unacceptable. This is about whether we can be honest with ourselves. Now, after years of hiding and running from the truth, the brothers are able at last to be honest. But can we be honest with ourselves? You know, we know that there's so much wrong with us, don't we? We know about our sinfulness, and yet we still somehow manage to have quite a high opinion of ourselves, don't we? And of our own opinions and worth. But the only worth we have is because God has called us and by his grace enabled our sins to be forgiven. And it's that that brings value to us. Well, then we go into the whole thing about the money in the sacks. And that raises the question, what all that is about. Why does Joseph choose to put the brothers' money back in their sacks? Let's just take a look at it. Verse 25. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and to restore every man's money into his sack. And off they go in verse 26. And verse 27, and as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he espied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God hath done unto us? So they see this now as something. God is involved in this somehow, and they don't know how, and they don't know how this is all going to play out. But God must be behind this that is happening to them. It's just too strange. It's too scary for there to be any other explanation. Well, what the brothers have just done is they have said, this trouble is happening to us because of what we did to Joseph years ago. Now, in a way, they were right. They were having their comeuppance for what they did to Joseph years ago. And so there is an element of retribution about it. But that thinking, I have to suffer now because of what I did years ago, that's a transactional way of thinking, isn't it? And what does Joseph do? He puts money into their sacks. And money is all about transactions and a transactional way of thinking. And if we had to pick one word to sum up what I think this money and the sacks is about, it's about payback. And the brothers are having payback, yes, for what they did, but not in the sense of, you know, they did such a bad thing to Joseph, so if Joseph now does a bad thing to them, then it'll all be okay. They'll all be even, and we'll get salvation, won't we? Well, of course we won't get salvation by that, will we? An eye for an eye will not bring us salvation. There is no price that the brothers can pay that will enable them to be forgiven. There is no price. They can't redeem themselves and they can't redeem their other brothers, can they, in that sense? No man can do that or give to God a ransom for him. There is no price that can be paid. This is not a transaction. Salvation and forgiveness is not done on that basis, is it? And they come to buy corn. You know, we give you money and you give us corn. And Joseph's saying, no, I don't want your money. And I don't want you to suffer either, really. I just want you to learn the lesson and to be reconciled and the family to be as one again. So payback is not the basis of salvation. You can just, you know when you're at a restaurant and there's two of you and you're both saying, oh, I'll get this, and the other one says, no, I'll get this, no, I'll get this. You know, it's a little bit like that. They keep trying to give him their money and Joseph keeps saying, no, I don't want your money. It's not about the money. And it's not about them suffering a certain amount to make things right again. This is about getting the brothers into a place where they can be forgiven. And the forgiveness that Joseph will offer to them and the reconciliation that will be brought about will not be brought about on the basis of, oh, it's fair now because you've suffered enough. It will be on the basis that Joseph freely forgives them and says, it's okay. What you did was wrong, but I forgive you. You've confessed it and you know it's wrong. And I forgive you for doing it. And, you know, this happens twice, doesn't it? Joseph puts the money in their sacks and they bring it back. And they give him some more money to buy the next load of corn. And Joseph puts it back in their sacks again and says, no, I don't want it. This is not a transactional thing. This is about grace. Well, let's go on. And the brothers come back now, of course. They go back home and tell Jacob all this, and then they get hungry again. They leave Simeon. You know, they don't go back because to get Simeon back, they wait till they run out of food, which is a bit of a shame for Simeon, I always feel. But eventually the food runs out, and they know they have to go back again. And they go back with Benjamin. And when they go back, Joseph invites them for dinner, which again scares them. But before they have dinner with Joseph, they speak to Joseph's steward. And they say to him, you know, something very strange happened when we left last time. We found all our money was back in our sacks, and we brought it back again, and we brought some more money to pay for the next lot of grain that we're going to be needing. And the steward says, he says, verse 23, "Peace be to you. Fear not. Your God and the God of your father hath given you your treasure in your sacks. I had your money," and he brought Simeon out unto them. Peace be to you. Do you remember how the brothers couldn't speak peace? And now, them being true men, them having brought the money back, the steward on Joseph's behalf says, "Peace be to you. God has given you your treasure in your sacks." It's God who will provide. This is God's doing. Yeah, and that's interesting when we think about this as being a parable about salvation, isn't it? That the steward should say that. It's a wonderful thing. Now, the brothers are very scared about this meal that they're going to have with Joseph. Verse 18, "And the men were afraid because they were brought unto Joseph's house, and they said, because of the money that was returned in our sacks at the first time are we brought in, that he may seek occasion against us. And they come near to the steward," we should have looked at this verse before, "and they stood at the door of the house speaking with him." And so there's a doorway there, and they know there's trouble through that doorway. They know this is not going to be good, but they have to go through it, don't they? And you can sympathize with them in a way, but that's how it is. They have to go in. There is no other way than that they should go through that door and sit down with Joseph. And so, verse 25, "They made ready the presents against Joseph came at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there." Now, the present, then, is something that's mentioned in a few passages. The present is Jacob's idea. And that harks back to another present. Do you remember when Jacob was going to meet Esau? He prepared an elaborate present, hoping to curry favor with Esau and bring about reconciliation by this present. And Esau completely swept the present aside. And a very similar thing happens here. All this fuss is made about the present. Jacob comes up with the idea of the present. They bring the present and they put it in, and they set it down ready for when Joseph comes. And when Joseph comes, what does he do? He doesn't even mention the present. Joseph's not interested in the present. You can't buy Joseph off with a present. That isn't what this is about. There's a couple of other verses as well in this chapter. Verse 27. Joseph asks them of their welfare. And you know how you do that, don't you? You use the word peace. That's how you ask. Is there peace with you? And again, the contrast with they could not speak peaceably to him, and Joseph now asking of their welfare, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spake? Is he still alive?" And in verse 32, "And they set on for Joseph by himself, and for them by themselves, and for the Egyptians which should eat with them by themselves, because the Egyptians don't eat bread with the Hebrews." So, well, this is a funny meal, wasn't it? Now, do you remember the last meal that the brothers had eaten with Joseph? Well, They hadn't eaten with Joseph because they'd cast Joseph into a pit and then they sat down to eat bread, didn't they? And now Joseph sits them down to eat bread and he sits and he has his own bread this time and he sends portions to them from his table. So it's the exact reversal, isn't it? They eat separately again, but this time Joseph's eating too, and it's Joseph providing them with food. Well, then they leave. That evening goes very well, and they leave. And, of course, the first verse of the next chapter, chapter 44, and Joseph commanded the steward of his house, saying, "Fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, put every man's money in his sack," so there's the transactional point being made again, "and put the silver cup in." Verse 4, "Up, follow after those men, and when thou dost overtake them, say unto them, wherefore have ye rewarded evil for good?" Transactional language, isn't it, again? I've just shown you good, and you've shown me evil. That's a repetition of what happened. He's accusing them of a repetition of what had happened back in chapter 37, where they had shown Joseph evil. "Is not this cup that in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing." So what is this about? We've talked about the money in the sacks. What is the silver cup about? And why should it be mentioned that this is a divining cup? Well, I think this is also a playback of chapter 37. If the silver cup is symbolic, it's symbolic of Joseph's power to divine, to be in touch with what God's will is, and to know what is going to happen. Now that's exactly what the brothers had denied in chapter 37, isn't it? Joseph had told them his dreams, and they had hated him for it. And they had tried to stop that happening by selling him into slavery. And Jacob had said, "Shall we indeed come down and bow ourselves to you, to the earth?" And here again, Joseph is now accusing them of taking away, or denying effectively, his ability to know what's going to happen by stealing his silver cup. So it's a replay of what had happened back in chapter 37. Well, let's see what happens here. The brothers come back to Joseph in Egypt, and in verse 15, Joseph says to them, "What deed is this that ye have done? Watch ye not that such a man as I can certainly divine?" That's ironic, isn't it? In the light of chapter 37 and the dreams and the theft of this cup. Joseph can divine with or without his cup, thank you very much. It's not about the cup that had any particular powers of divination. That was just a metaphor for Joseph's ability to be in touch with God and for God to reveal to him what is going to be. And Judah says, "What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he with whom the cup is found." And this now is a comprehensive recognition of guilt, isn't it? And that's where we need to be. That's the point that Joseph had to bring his brethren to in order that this reconciliation, this forgiveness, and this grace could be bestowed upon them. Notice the language that Judah couches this in. "What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves?" There's nothing we can say to excuse what we've done. And of course, again, this is two levels. He's not talking about this, or he is, but really it's about the other thing, isn't it? The unspoken thing that he's talking here. And this reminds me of Romans 3, you know, where Paul goes through the great catalogue of all the evils that men and women have done in the earth, and brings us to a point where we have nothing to say for ourselves. We've stopped trying to defend ourselves and make excuses for ourselves. That's the point that the brothers have got to hear, that every mouth should be stopped and all the world should be guilty before God. "What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. And he always does, doesn't he? Because God sees everything. And so what can we do but be open with him and say, Lord, please forgive us for what we have done. And this then now is the fulcrum upon which the narrative can pivot. And it does so with that beautiful prayer of Judah's, which begins in verse 18 and carries on through to the end of chapter 44. Now, we're not going to go through that prayer because we don't have time. I'll just perhaps just make two comments about it in a second. But the result of the prayer is there at the beginning of chapter 45. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him. And it's just such a powerful scene, isn't it? It gets me every time I read that scene. And these tears of Joseph, you know, well, there are seven sets of them. Joseph cries seven times. In the narrative. And there they all are. And why does he cry here? He cries because of the beauty of Judah's confession. He cries because he sees that they have changed. He cries because he sees that now they know where they have come from, and now they know where they need to go. And Joseph doesn't want them to suffer anymore. He just wants to hug them. He just wants to embrace them and to make himself known to them and to say, I'm glad to be able to save you, and there's nothing more that I want in the world than that we should be one again as a family, and that he should forgive them. It's a priceless thing that happens here. And why does it happen? It happens because of that confession of Judah. And what is it in the confession of Judah that is so powerful? Well, there are many things that are powerful in it. But but one of them is the fact that Judah's plea is not about himself. It's not about the brothers. It's not about Benjamin or Joseph. It's about the father. It's about Jacob, yes, but it's about the father. And that expression about the father is used, I think, 14 times in the prayer. And Judah knows that, you know, not everything's been right in the family in which he's grown up. And he recognizes his father's favoritism for what it is and the problems that it's caused. But now he's come to the maturity that he can accept it and he can forgive it too. And that enables then this symbolic thing to play out where Judah now becomes a type of Christ, where because of his love of the Father, he is prepared to sacrifice himself so that Benjamin can be free and so that Jacob can be happy. Verse 33. Now therefore I pray thee, let my servant abide instead of the lad, a bondman to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brethren. For how shall I go up to my father, and the lad be not with me, lest peradventure I see the evil that shall come upon my father? So Judah now sacrifices himself. This isn't like what Reuben said. This isn't take my two sons, take someone else. This is Judah saying, I will sacrifice myself because I love my Father. And you don't need me to tell you that that's like the Lord Jesus Christ. And so the whole narrative from chapter 37 right through to the end, we were talking this afternoon, what are the big lessons from the Joseph narrative? And one of the biggest lessons of all has to be that the family that was once estranged is brought together again, this reconciliation. And that was the theme, or a crucial theme, in the Jacob narrative. And that is a crucial theme in the Joseph narrative too. And it's a very difficult thing to achieve, that, isn't it? And but one day, by God's grace, we will all come in that unity that is spoken of in the New Testament, and God will gather together in one all things in Christ Jesus, and that will be the ultimate fulfillment, won't it, of these wonderful things that are spoken to us in this story of Joseph.